Okay. So let's get started here. I sent out an email earlier this morning. I don't know if many of you got it. Just to re-emphasize, to reduce the distractions in class, I'm going to request, or not request, but enforce a closed laptop policy. No laptop should be open during class. Too many distractions. I see people not really paying attention. Okay, so really pay attention, and to make this less of a harsh policy, I got fine Belgian chocolates on the menu today. Okay, so if you say something, you can come by, pick one up at the end of the class. Okay. So few things to keep in mind. There's a project out, the first real project. I will talk about it at the end of today's class. I presume most of you went to the discussion section yesterday. Okay, there was some discussion of what the project entails, and I'm going to have to say more about that today. Okay. The other things to keep in mind are there's another homework that is due soon. Okay, there was a typo on the homework. I sent out a clarification yesterday. Okay, so keep that in mind. The web page has been updated and the typo has been fixed, but somebody brought it to our attention, so that's good that it was caught ahead of time. Okay, so one homework due this week, project due in a couple of weeks, first midterm coming up in early March. Okay, so lots of things on the plate, so it's important to really keep up with the class and not fall behind. Okay, yes, question. Oh, sure. If you want it, if you want to have it, turn it in sometime before 9 p.m., let's say, that should be fine. I'll make the adjustment in the Spire so it doesn't mark it late if you send it in after 5. Okay, so that's not a problem. Okay. The other thing to announce here is if you prefer to handwrite, because you have to upload this to Spark, if you prefer to handwrite your solution, there is a PDF scanner in the CSCF room here. You can just go, it's a one-touch scanner, you just stick the sheet and press a button, a PDF comes up, you just upload that. Some people have done that. I'm trying to put a PDF scanner in the EdLab. That hasn't happened yet, but in the meantime, you can use this scanner. Okay, that scanner is only available during business hours. So if you get done at 8 p.m., it won't be available. That's the only thing to keep in mind. If you typeset your homework and upload it, there's no problem. Question? Yes. As a doc, yeah, that's fine. Yeah, that's fine. You can send it in as a Word document. That should be fine. Okay, so let's recap what we were doing last time. So we talked about semaphores. It's important you understand this because the project is actually based on semaphores. Okay, so you said semaphore is a special integer that supports two atomic operations, a wait and a signal. A wait is operation allows you to get the semaphore if it's available. It also decrements the value of the semaphore. Okay, a signal operation releases the semaphore, wakes up a process if one is waiting, and also increments the value of the semaphore if not. We talked about two types of semaphores, binary semaphores, which are also called mutex semaphores. So these are semaphores that take values 0 and 1. They're typically used for enforcing locks. Okay? But we also saw that you could use semaphores, binary semaphores in particular, but also counting semaphores to sleep and wake up threads. Okay? So you can control which threads sleep when the threads wake up by you doing wait and signal. Wait causes you to go to sleep. If the semaphore is initialized to 0, you do a wait, you will go to sleep. Okay? And the signal from some other thread will then explicitly wake this thread up. So if you want to control the order in which you sleep and wake up to some task, then you can also use semaphores in addition to their use as locks. Okay? So we talked about mutual exclusion, progress and bounded waiting. So today we are going to continue from that discussion, okay, and then move on to the next synchronization primitives called monitors, okay, and condition variables. So we'll first talk about what semaphores do and don't do for us. Okay, what's wrong with them? And we'll see how monitors are a higher level synchronization primitive that address some of these limitations. Okay, we'll see how to implement monitors. Okay, we'll talk about two types of monitors, MESA monitors and HOR monitors. And then we'll do some comparison, okay, between semaphores and monitors. And then at the end of the class, I'll also talk about the project, okay, and as it relates to the semaphores. So what's wrong with semaphores? So they are a low-level synchronization primitive, like lock. Okay, you have a wait and a signal that corresponds to an acquire and a release. Okay, so they do what they're supposed to do. Okay, but they're still fairly low-level, which means that depending on where you put the wait and the signal, you may have problems or bugs with your code. Okay, and these are some of the issues that result or trigger those problems. Okay, first of all, they're shared global variables. That by itself is not bad. But the bigger issue is there is no direct connection between a semaphore and the critical section it is trying to protect. Okay, so you have to declare the semaphore somewhere and you use it somewhere else. Okay, they are not directly connected. It would be much nicer if for every critical section there was a synchronization primitive that was directly bound to it. Okay, and I'll sort of say what that means again in a moment. Okay, access to the semaphore can come from anywhere from a program. Okay, other than just in places where there is a critical section. This has a problem where if something goes wrong, if your program hangs or it has a deadlock, okay, it's hard to debug. You don't know which thread actually called some primitive and the semaphore that caused the program to hang or some problems to crop up. Okay. The other issue is semaphores can be used either for mutual exclusion or locking or for scheduling. And a priori, just by looking at a semaphore, you don't know which of the two users you are going to see in your program. Okay? So this makes it harder to debug. Is it really a lock or is it something that is allowing threads to sleep and wake up in a certain order? Okay, that's another problem. Okay? And then it does not directly enforce any guarantee of correct usage. Okay? You can easily put the raw wait or a signal in incorrect places and cause bugs to appear in your program. So what this says, what all of this says is somehow this synchronization that we have been looking at, it is at one level too low for you to write higher level code that is correct and is known to be correct. Okay, so we are going to now look at a primitive called a monitor, which is a higher level primitive. It gives us similar properties, okay, but is much easier to use. Okay, so what is a monitor? So monitor is basically, think of it as a class. Just as you have a Java class, it's a class that ties together data, okay, any shared data you have, any operations on that data, as well as the synchronization primitive. So this class allows you to encapsulate any shared data, any operations that you want in the data, which is basically your critical section, as well as the synchronization that you have to do in order to access that shared data or perform any operations on it. Okay? Unlike a normal class, monitors guarantee mutual exclusion. Okay, this means that only one thread can be executing any method of that monitor, or that monitor is a special class at any given time. This is guaranteed to you by the monitor. Okay, so you don't have to put in any additional synchronization. If you just declare the class to be a monitor, you automatically get that property. Any thread calls any method on that class, all other threads that call any other methods have to block, okay, until that thread is done. Okay, and we'll see that monitors require shared data to be private, so that you can only access them from within these methods. So that's the intuition. So here is a more formal definition. Okay, what does the monitor do? It basically declares a lock for that class. Okay, so that you can prevent or restrict only one thread from entering that class method at any given time. So there is always a lock associated with the monitor, and then there are some condition variables. Okay, this is a new synchronization construct that we haven't seen so far. Locks you already know about. Okay, so the monitor uses the lock to ensure only one thread can call any method at any given time. That's the purpose of the lock. Okay, and condition variables, okay, are another construct that allow the thread to go to sleep inside a method, okay, and release the lock at the same time. Okay, if for any reason, okay, you are executing a method in this class and you have to sleep, okay, you shouldn't just blindly sleep because you are holding this lock. Okay, and while you are holding this lock, every other thread that is trying to execute any method is blocked. So if you go to sleep, all those threads will just keep waiting. Okay, so condition variables are a construct that allow you to atomically give up the lock okay, and go to sleep. Okay. And it is guaranteed that when you wake up, you have reacquired the lock. Okay. So basically what this is saying is, I need to block for some reason. Okay. And while I am blocked, I am going to give the lock to someone else and let them do what they want. But I want to get the lock back when I wake up, because I am holding the lock, so it's really my lock at this point, but I can temporarily give it up while I am asleep. And that's essentially what condition variables allow you to do. Okay, so you can go to sleep and release the lock in one atomic operation, and when you come out of this sleep mode, you're going to get the lock back. The monitors actually guarantee that to you. Okay, the condition variable semantics guarantee this for you. Okay, we'll see examples of code in just a moment. These are the two things that a monitor has. Okay, it has a lock and it has zero or more condition variables associated with it. Okay, we'll see examples of how to use this. So what can you do with this? You can encapsulate the shared data, okay, and then monitors automatically acquire the lock for you, okay, in certain languages. In others, you have to explicitly get the lock. You can do operations on shared data. You can give up the lock. If you cannot do something, you can go to sleep, reacquire it, and then you can release. Okay, so here is an example of some code. Okay. Now it turns out monitors are already built into Java, okay, at the language level. Okay. There's a keyword called synchronized in Java. If you add the word synchronized to any method of a class, okay, that class turns into a monitor. Okay, so you can take any generic class that you have, use this keyword synchronized, and that class automatically turns into a monitor. What does that mean? What does it mean to turn into a monitor? As soon as you do this, internally Java will declare a lock for this class. Okay. You can put the synchronized. Typically, if you are you want a monitor, you will actually put the word synchronized on each method. But doesn't matter how many methods you do, but every non-private method, okay, needs to use the word synchronized if you want to protect shared variables. Okay. So as soon as you do this, internally Java will declare a class for you. You don't have to declare classes. You don't have to acquire release classes. Automatically, this is going to happen inside for you. Okay, so all you have done is done this. So what that means is, if any object, if any thread calls the method add, okay, if it enters add, it's guaranteed that it's already grabbed the lock. Okay, Java has grabbed the lock for you. This thread holds the lock. Okay, and then when you exit this class, exit this method, the lock is automatically released. Okay, and if any thread is executing in any method that has synchronized keyword, okay, all other threads will be blocked. Okay, if they try to enter, so somebody is executing add, and then some other thread calls remove, okay, it will block, because that first thing that happens when you try to enter any method with word synchronize is try to grab this lock. Okay. And so if some other thread already has it, so you are blocked. So you don't really deal with the low level details of when to grab a lock, when to release a lock. Just by adding the synchronized keyword, you tell Java, saying go construct a lock for this class, and any method that has this word synchronized should ensure that when a thread calls it, you have to grab the lock. Yes, question there.
I have two questions.
Yeah.
When you say it turns into a monitor, does that mean it has all the same things? Or you said in a monitor, all data has to be private.
Yeah.
In a regular class, so you can have public
yes.
data. Is all the public data become private? Or?
No. So there are some rules you have to follow in order to make the class a real monitor. Like any class, you can have public data, okay? But if the data is public, then you can access it from some other class without calling a method. So there are no locks protecting that data. Okay? So if you have public data in a class, you might have synchronous keywords. Access to that public data is not protected by a lock. Multiple threads can go and trample on it, and bad things can happen. If you really want to share data across threads, okay, then the rule is you should make that data private, so that only methods of this class can access it. Okay? And then you add the word synchronized, keyword synchronized to those methods, so that only one thread can access that data. Okay? So by following these two simple rules, you have ensured that shared data can be accessed by only one thread at a time, and locking is taken care of. Yes.
Do you take yourself by making any shared data static or final?
Good.
That way, access
in here.
Yes.
Yes.
But it's still public.
Well, it should be private. If it's public, then you can access it from outside, right?
But if it can't be it be changed?
Oh, it, yes. If it cannot be changed, then it's really not, it's only read-only really from outside. Then you don't really need a lock at some level, unless somebody is changing it internally. If somebody is going to change it internally, then you should try to make it private and use the word synchronize. But if it's really a constant, static and a constant, then it doesn't matter. Okay, then you can use it. Yes, there are some more questions.
If it is public and there is synchronized, does that mean that another thread could go into the class or not?
If the data is public and you have synchronized. So first of all, only methods which have the keyword synchronized will be protected by the law. You could have methods here without the word synchronized. Arbitrary number of threads could be executing those methods. No guarantees are made. Okay? Only methods with keyword synchronized will be protected. Okay? And on top of it, if your data is public, then you don't even need a method to access it. So you can access it from outside. Okay, there are some more questions. Yes.
It also signals back once it releases the lock.
When do you release the lock? Is that the question? No.
Yeah, if you have synchronized in terms of the method, it signals back once it releases the lock.
Yeah, so here you will release the lock. Internally, Java will see if some other thread is waiting on any of these synchronized methods, and if one of those threads will be woken up, they will get the lock. Okay? So if, think of this as synchronized is equivalent. In fact, if you read the Java documentation, it will say that synchronized is equivalent to basically doing a lock acquire as the first statement of that method and the lock release at the as the last statement. Okay? So if some other thread, there's a lock release that's implicit by adding the word synchronize and a lock acquire that's implicit. You don't have to write that code, it's internally generated for you. Okay? So, yeah, question there.
When you have a synchronized method like that, one thread is currently running it, you have another thread try to access it. Does the thread trying to access it constantly pull it, or does it go to
sleep? There's a thread. Okay, the question is, if you are in a synchronized method, if some other thread try to access this, what happened? So internally, it is going to block. That's the Java's implementation of a lock. Okay, Java could have implemented busy wait, in which case it would do polling. But really, the way they implemented it is, it will sleep, and when you do a release, one of those threads will be woken up. Okay. But the nice thing is, you don't need to deal with all of that. If you really use low-level locks, you have to decide where to put the lock, where to do the release. Here it's all taken care of for you. Okay, so it's a much higher level construct that is giving you synchronization. Okay, is that clear? What monitors are? Okay. So now this is the locking part of the monitor. I said the monitors are two parts. There's a lock and there are condition variables. So here, you only have by adding synchronize, you only done the locking part. So let's look at the remove method. Okay? So this is clearly a buffer where the add is adding something to a queue and remove is removing something from the queue. So what is remove doing? It's taking, if queue is not empty, it removes the item and it returns the item. Okay? If the queue is empty, on the other hand, it will just return. It will not do anything. Okay? Remove is not going to do something if the queue is empty. Now, if you want that thread to wait until some item actually appears and then you remove an object from the queue, just as you did in producers and consumers. In the consumers blocked, okay, when there was nothing in the queue or nothing in the shared buffer. Okay. So if you want to do that, okay, then you have to do it carefully, because if you just go to sleep here, if you just say sleep for 10 seconds or something like that, remember that you are still holding the lock. Okay? So nobody will be able to add if you are still holding the lock and you sleep. The only way to do this is to go to sleep or block, but release the lock so some other threads can make progress, and then when you wake up, maybe there is an object in the queue. Okay? So that's basically what condition variables allow you to do. So it says, how can we change remove to wait until something is on the queue? So you want to go to sleep inside a critical section, but you don't want to hold on to the lock while you're sleeping. You want to give it up. Okay? And when you wake up, okay, you want to then reacquire the lock, because you are now in a synchronized class, and the guarantee is if you are executing any statement, you hold the lock. Okay? So if you wake up, you want to reacquire the lock. Again, this is done automatically for you by this notion of condition variables. Condition variables allow you to go to sleep, and any lock is atomically released. When you wake up, you get the lock back. Okay, so here are the primitives on condition variable, they look very similar to semaphores, as you will see. So if you do wait and you specify the lock, then you atomically release this lock, go to sleep. Okay, when the processor thread wakes up, you reacquire the lock. Okay. And then some other thread can do a signal, okay, which will wake up the thread if one exists, and if there are no threads blocked, then signal will do nothing. Okay. And you could do a broadcast or what's called signal all to wake up all waiting threads. Okay. There are three primitives. There's a wait, signal, and a broadcast. Wait causes you to go to sleep, release the lock. Signal causes you to wake up a thread that had actually released the lock, okay, and wake it up again. Okay. And the rule is you must have actually be holding the lock when you do any of these operations. Otherwise, things go wrong. So here is the same code, okay, that actually now uses wait and notify as condition variables. So basically in Java, again, all of this is built in. So the methods are called something different. So wait. Yes, let me just write this down. So this abstract notion of a wait on a condition variable is basically the wait method. Okay. And signal is basically it's called notify. And broadcast is notify all. Okay, so here is basically the same code. Okay. So what does the add do? Okay, it synchronizes, it puts an item on the queue, it says notify. Notify says if there is some thread that is blocked, okay, wake it up. That's all it's doing here. Okay, and if no thread is blocked, it does nothing. Okay, so after every add, you just do a notify, saying if somebody was blocked waiting for an item to consume an item, let's wake that thread up. Okay. And here is the remove statement. The remove statement says while the queue is empty, okay, go to sleep and give up the lock. Okay. So you just sit there in a loop waiting for the queue to become non-empty. Okay. And so after every notify, you will be woken up. At that point, you can check if the queue is empty. If you actually put an item on the queue and the queue has become non-empty, you will come out of this while loop and you will consume the item. Okay. So this is where you will sleep and give up the lock, and that is what might cause you to be woken up. Okay. Yes. Yes, you first need to have synchronized in the method. Yeah, otherwise, you shouldn't use notify because there's no lock to give up if you haven't grabbed the lock in the first place. Okay, so synchronize is what causes you to grab the lock. So you can do a notify only if you are in a synchronized method or some method that you're called from a synchronized method.
You don't have to specify on what condition variable the threads are waiting.
You don't have to. So this is abstract code.
You don't have to tell it which condition variable.
So this depends on the language. Okay. In most languages, you actually have to specify. You declare a condition variable and you specify this. Okay. In Java, it's implicit that you are releasing this lock. If you don't specify it, you are releasing the lock you are holding using the word synchronized. Okay. What condition variable is it? So
say like we have different conditions saying the queue is empty or the queue is full. And
so you can declare, so there's one implicit one that is going to be for this one, for the lock that you hold. If you need additional condition variables, you can declare them in addition. Okay? There's one that will be default for the lock that you already held. But you don't have to just release that lock. You could have other locks in your code, in which case you will explicitly declare condition. So what I'm trying to say is there's an implicit one that you use here. Okay. But you can have more than one condition variable, in which case you have to name. You have to say condition var dot notify, whatever you declared there. This is like saying this, but the implicit one dot notify. Okay. So this is basically shorthand.
So this is the one this is going to notify the threads that are waiting on the
lock that you have for the synchronized. Yeah, exactly. Yes, so let me repeat what this says, just in case it's not clear. So every time you add an object on the queue and you do a notify, this notify will wake up any thread that has gone to sleep, okay, waiting for an object. Okay, in particular, you'll see the code here. So here the remove basically checks, is the queue empty? The queue is empty, I'm going to wait until some object is inserted into the queue, and that you do by using wait. Okay? And you basically give up the lock and go to sleep atomically, and then this notify will cause this to be woken up. Okay, question there.
How fair is
it?
Yeah.
Is that the question? So notify, it depends on the implementation. Okay, typical implementation will do FIFO. Okay? So you might have lots of threads, all of which have might have gone to sleep for a variety of reasons. Okay? And so you can basically wake up the first thread that has slept. If you do a notify all threads will be woken up. Okay? And then they have to contend for the lock. So only one of them will actually grab the lock. Others will basically have to go back to sleep. Okay? That's the reason there's a while here, not an if. Okay, so notify all wakes up all threads, then now it's a free for all. All of them will contend for the lock, only one of them will actually get the lock. Okay, only that thread will actually wake up and exit, come out of the wait. The others will not do anything. Okay? That clear? Okay, so fairness is important, but it's usually FIFO in the most implementation. Okay, so turns out there are two types of semantics for monitors. One are what are called MESA style. Okay? This is the one that most real systems use. And there is a Hoare style, which I guess some classical textbooks have used to introduce the concept of monitors. Okay? They do more or less the same thing, but there is some small difference between the two, and we'll look at what they are. So the issue here is, if somebody does a notify or a notify all, okay, who gets woken up and who gets the lock? Okay. In the MESA style, the thread that calls the notify or the signal keeps the lock. All it has done is it's woken up the other thread, but it hasn't yet given up the lock. Okay. In this case, when you're done a notify, you haven't yet given up the lock. You could have some other code here and then you exit. You're just woken up that thread. Okay, so you keep the lock. All you're doing is the wake up part of notify. Okay. In the Hoare style, on the other hand, okay, as soon as you do a notify, the control of the lock automatically passes to the thread that is woken up. Okay, so you not only do a notify or a signal, you also give up the lock and the waiting thread actually gets the lock. Okay. And so as soon as that thread wakes up, it already has the lock, it can proceed to execute. Okay. So that's the difference. Okay. So the only real difference between the two is both will cause any thread that is sleeping to wake up. Okay. But in one case, not only do you wake that up, you also hand it the lock, saying, here is the lock, I woke you up, do what you need to do. In the other case, you just wake it up. Okay. So it's now woken up, but you keep the lock, and when you exit your method, you give up the lock and that thread can actually continue execution. Okay, that's the real difference. So then you can ask the question, if you were to, so what we really saw was this, the code, this is what real systems do. If you had to write the same code as the previous slide using Hoare style, what would you do or what would change? The answer is really not much changes. The only thing that you'll see different is this while becomes an if. Because what happens when you do a notify is you not only wake up a thread, one thread that is sleeping, okay, you also give it the lock. So this thread is guaranteed that it was woken up, so the queue must be not empty here because you just put an item in the queue. Okay. In MESA style semantics, okay, that's a while simply because you have no guarantee. You could have just started up a new thread that just entered into this synchronized method and took the item before you even woke up or got scheduled. You have no control over how the CPU scheduler schedules you. Okay? You may be woken up, but you may wait for some time before you actually run. In the meantime, a new thread could start, it would enter, it would consume the item, which is why you need a while. In the normal MESA case, saying, I've woken up, but I'm still not guaranteed the queue is empty, so let me check again. Okay, and then you do a check. And if the queue is still not empty, only then do you exit. In Hoare style, this is not required because the lock control is directly passed to you. So you know that no other thread could have entered this critical section. So you don't need to have a while. You can just exit the if directly and remove the item. Okay, that's the only difference. It's mostly pedagogical. You'll never write real code that looks like this. Right? But it's important to understand the difference. Okay. So although this course is not going to require you to know about monitors in C and C++, I wanted to say a few words about this. Java makes it really easy. It's all built in, so it's simple to use. In other languages, really, it's slightly more complicated. There are no language level constructs. You have to use libraries to do this. In C or C++, you would, for instance, use pthreads. The pthreads is the POSIX threading package that comes with its own implementation of locks and condition variables and semaphores and so on. Okay. So there is no, first of all, there is no synchronized keyword. Okay. So to construct monitor, you have to explicitly add code. Okay. So here is the same code written in C++. Okay. So what you do, so you don't have this synchronized. So what you have to do is the first line and the last line, you will explicitly add a lock acquire and a lock release. This was code that Java actually generated and executed for you just by implementing synchronize. So you have to explicitly put that code. Okay, the acquire and release. So same is true here. Any method that was synchronized in Java and C++, you explicitly put the lock release and lock acquire. Okay, as the first and the last line. Okay, condition variables are similar. Okay, so there's pthreads condition variable. You have signal and you have wait. Okay, so that code hasn't changed. So you put an item, you do a signal. Here you have this while loop which is checking whether the queue is empty. And then if not, you will basically do a wait. So that part hasn't changed. What has changed is you really don't have this benefit of synchronize that doing all the locking for you automatically. So to do explicit locking. Okay, that clear? Okay, so here is our bounded buffer. Okay, that add and release stuff that we talked about. Now this is our producer's consumer bounded buffer problem. Okay, using condition variables. So this is assuming C kind of code. So you will have either lock acquire or lock release. If this was Java, these two statements wouldn't exist and you would have put synchronized here. Okay, that's the only difference between C and C++. So let's ignore the lock part here. So what does the rest do? The rest basically checks. If you remember the same thing we did for semaphores. Okay? You say, is the buffer full? That's the producer is trying to append. Is the buffer full? If so, you wait. Okay? You're basically going to wait for the consumer to consume one data item. Okay? And then if the buffer is not full, if there's at least one slot where you can append, then you will basically go and append that data item. It's a circular buffer. You increment the count saying how many things do you have, and then you basically do pull dot signal. Okay. In the consumer, you check for buffer underflows. Is the buffer completely empty? If then you wait for the producer to produce something. Okay. If there's at least one data item to consume, you go ahead and consume it. You decrement the count. Okay, and you do empty dot signal. This empty dot signal is the one that is actually going to cause that to be woken up. Okay, these are condition variables. So if the buffer was full and you did a wait, okay, that's a condition variable wait, here you will be woken up. When you do the signal, this will say, okay, go wake that up because it gave up the lock for me. Okay, so you're doing the same thing using condition variable as opposed to semaphores. Okay?
Are you creating new condition variables in Java?
Okay, how do you create? So there is a way to do that. We can look at the Java API, but let's wait on that for just a few seconds. Okay, the same java.concurrent is basically the packet. There's a lock class in there, there's a condition variable class in there. Okay, we'll look at that. Okay, any questions on this? Because now we are going to compare semaphores and monitors. Yes, question. Yes. This one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that one that automatically gets the lock and it goes in the remove one, but that one doesn't. And other threads can go, how could they enter the synchronize?
How could they enter? Because you have given up your lock here. So question was, is the question clear? The question was not here. I guess we need to go back two slides. This one. So I said, why do you need a why? Yeah, that's a good question. Okay, so if this did a notify, if this is woken up, so all that the notify does is it says, wake this guy up. It hasn't yet woken up. It hasn't yet reacquired the lock. The lock is still with add. Okay? So all that is going to be done is at some point this goes back into the run queue for the CPU scheduler to run. Okay? In the CPU scheduler run, this will explicitly reacquire the lock within the wait method and then exit the wait method. Okay? So you don't have the lock yet. All you've been woken up. Okay? So you may exit the add method, in which case the lock is given up. Okay? Some other thread could come along, newly created thread could come along. It could call the remove method. Okay? That remove method, since this lock was given up, that thread could, this third thread could grab the lock. It could enter, queue is not empty because this add has just put in, it would remove that item and exit. Okay? And then this thread that was explicitly woken up will actually get scheduled. Okay? It will, in the wait, it will reacquire the lock. It will come out of the wait. And the object that was put in the queue is gone. Okay, this is why you have to do a while. Is that clear, what I just said? First, the question needs to be clear. Otherwise, the solution, what I said, will not make any sense. Okay, the question is, why do you need to actually, once you come out of the wait, why do you need to go back in the while and check whether the queue is empty? Aren't you guaranteed that this add object has actually put an thing in the queue? You are in a synchronized method, so why do you need to check this? Okay, the answer is, all that this notify has done is it has woken up this thread that was blocked here. Okay, the thread is not run yet. Okay, so all you have done is it's woken up. It doesn't yet have the lock. The lock is still with add. Okay, add can exit, give up the lock. Okay. And because we don't control how the CPU scheduler schedules this thread, a third thread could come along called remove, even before this thread that woken up gets to run. It can enter, okay, because the add gave up the lock, it can enter, remove the data item. And then this thread that woken up, it's a laggard thread, it wakes up, it reacquires the lock, comes out of the wait, thing is gone. Okay, so that's why you need to do a while, and if this empty, then you go back to sleep. That's what this code does. So because you are doing concurrent programming, you never control in what order threads actually get scheduled. So you have to really write code. So that's really called a race condition. In some cases the code works, in some cases it doesn't work. Is that clear? Okay. Any other questions here? Okay, so now we'll discuss how semaphores and monitors relate to one another. Okay. So, question is, both of them have wait and signal methods. Okay, so question is, if you are given semaphores, can you construct condition variables? In particular, if I give you a semaphore class in Java, can you declare a condition variable class that essentially for condition.wait called semaphore.wait and for condition.signal called semaphore.signal? Okay, does that work or is there a problem with that? Any thoughts on this?
Only one class can call the parent class.
Only one class can call the parent class. Okay. Yeah. So don't worry about how semaphore.wait is implemented. Assume that you are given this class. Question is, can you then build a condition variable class using that class? Okay. In particular, is that code going to work for us? Okay. It turns out that that code actually doesn't work. Okay. And neither does this code, and I'll explain why on the next slide. In this class, this code is essentially the same as that class. Here you basically take the lock and release it. The problem with that code is, first of all, the condition.wait does not tell you which lock to release. Okay, because in the condition variable case, you are going to sleep and you are giving up a lock explicitly. Okay. Semaphores are no such concept. So you can't just do wait using a semaphore because you don't know what lock to give up. Okay. So here is another version of that condition.wait where you will explicitly release that lock and then go to sleep. Okay, and then when you wake up, you reacquire the lock. Okay, this is sort of what we said. Condition variables need to do. Okay. It turns out that even this code isn't really going to give us the semantics of condition variables. Okay. In other words, there is some difference between how semaphores work and how condition variables work. And let's look at what that difference is. Okay. The main difference is whether there is state or history that you track. Okay. It turns out that implicitly semaphores are tracking history, because semaphore is a counter, it's an integer variable. Every time you do a signal, you're incrementing, and every time you do a wait, you're decrementing. By doing so, you keep track of the state of the semaphore. Okay. You keep track of this counter. Condition variables don't explicitly have this counter. Okay. So, and because of this key difference, the two will behave differently. Okay. So, here is basically what the difference is. Okay, so let me just give you an example. So let's assume that semaphore is 1. So initialize the semaphore to 1. Do this. Okay. And then I also declare a condition variable. I do this. Okay, so this is semaphore, that's condition variable. The question is, what do these two weights do? Okay, what does this weight do? This is a condition variable, not a semaphore. Yes. Goes to sleep. There's a lock here. Okay, by definition, I said condition variable, whenever you call a wait, you atomically go to sleep always and give up the lock. Okay? There are no two ways to do this. You always go to sleep. Okay? What does this wait do? Okay, it's going to decrement and do what? Is it going to block or not block? You initialize it to 1, it will decrement it to 0, it's not negative. So this wait will actually continue execution, it will not block. Okay? In condition variable, no matter when you call the wait, you always go to sleep. Okay? In semaphores, whether you go to sleep or not depends on the value of the semaphore. Only if the value turns negative do you sleep, otherwise you don't sleep. Okay? That's a difference. So here you are always going to sleep, here you check the value of the semaphores and only conditionally go to sleep. Only if the value turns negative do you go to sleep. This is why there is a difference. Okay, this is why that code that I showed you on the previous slide doesn't work. There it says condition variable dot wait is semaphore dot wait. That is not going to work, because the semantics of condition variable say always sleep, doesn't matter. Okay? And semaphore says check the value, decrement it, check the value of the semaphore, only if it has turned negative do you go to sleep. So that's the key difference. This is why you can't just take a semaphore class and blindly turn it into a condition variable class. Okay. And the same is true of signal. Okay, so it turns out, and this is what I meant by state, because you are actually checking the value of the semaphore, that state of that semaphore. Okay, same thing is true of signal. So in both cases, if there's a threat sleeping, the signal will cause the threat to wake up. In this particular case, the two will behave identically. Okay? But on the other hand, if there is no threat sleeping, okay, signal here is going to go and increment the value of that variable. In this case, the signal does nothing. Okay? It is a no-op. If there's no threat sleeping, signal will do nothing. If there's a threat sleeping, you wake it up. If there's no threat sleeping, forget it. Doesn't do anything. Okay? In this case, you will go and increment that value. This will cause the subsequent weights behavior to change, because you actually change the state. Okay? So that's the main difference between the two. Okay, so that's the reason you can't just take. So the way you can actually put this formally is semaphore weight and signal are commutative. It doesn't matter in what order you do this, the end result is the same. Okay? In this case, the order matters. Okay? If thread 1 did a wait, and then subsequently thread 2 did a signal, this causes thread 1 to wake up. Okay? If you reverse the order, if thread 2 did a signal and thread 1 did a wait, this signal will check, is there some thread waiting? At this point there is none, so it does nothing. And then when thread 2 does a wait, it will block. Okay, so the order matters. In the semaphore, the order doesn't matter. Depending on whichever order you do a wait and a signal, because you have this counter, you get the same result. Okay, so that's the difference of what happens, because there is state in one and there is no state in the other. Okay, all that said, so what I have just argued is there is some difference between semaphores and condition variable. They both have this notion of wait and signal or notify, but they are not exactly the same. They behave differently. So you can't blindly take a semaphore and turn it into a condition variable, but you can actually do this. You should do it more carefully. And this is a implementation of monitors, an abstract pseudocode implementation with semaphores. I'll just give you the high order bit here. Okay. So all you really need to do here is check. Don't blindly do a signal. So because the wait and the signal, it matters when you go to sleep and when you do not go to sleep, you have to explicitly check the value of the semaphores, and depending on what the value is, you do different things. Okay, so that is basically condition variable dot wait that you are implementing using signal. So you check if the count is greater than 0, then only then do you explicitly do a signal. And here you check, is somebody explicitly waiting or not, and only then you wake it up. Otherwise you don't increment the value of the semaphore, because that will cause some problem. Okay. So the essential point is you have to deal with the state of the semaphore if you want to use a semaphore to implement a condition variable. Okay. So to explicitly check the value, okay, and do the right thing, because here wait always means wait. Okay, here wait actually goes and checks. So if you want to use this wait to block, you better do something that causes it to block. Okay, not just decrement the value and continue execution. So you can do this by explicitly checking the value and doing the right thing. Okay. Now this is not important from your perspective, because in Java you all get all of this for free. Okay. This discussion is only relevant to understand the real difference between semaphores and condition variables, because at a high level the method names on these synchronization primitives look the same. What they do also appears to be the same, but underneath they are different. Okay, that's the thing to keep in mind. Okay, so and this is, if you actually use that class, this is what you would do. You would basically, this is do a lock acquire and lock release at the end, and here is where you will actually try to resume your thread if you have somebody is blocked on this class. Okay? But as I said, so for the purposes of this course, this is all C code, or rather C++ code. So if you are actually programming in C++ and you are using semaphores and you wanted to use condition variables, all of this is relevant. In Java, it's not material, because it's all given to you. Okay? So now let me go back to that question that was raised about semaphores. So let's look at, just bring up the API. Okay, so this is the semaphore class in Java. Okay, let me also bring up the condition variables. Just a second. So you have to start there. Okay. So this is basically showing that you can add the word synchronize to increment and decrement. Okay. And then let me also look for condition variables. So this is in, I guess, let me go to the class. class. Now, util.concurrent. So you need to look for threads, that's a better way to do it. Okay, so here is a class example. I'm going around in circles here. Okay, let me find the right example, bring it back next time. Because I had thought I knew where to go and find it. That's the right one, but that's not the class of package names. Okay, here we go. So here is the lock, so it's in Java, and this is the condition variable. Class. Okay, it tells you, I see that there's wait, notify, and notify all. These are the three primitives. Okay, so let me just show you. Okay, on this, sorry. The condition variable is here. So this is your bounded buffer thing that I was talking about. There's a put and a take, which is the add and the remove. Okay. It's just showing you how to do this. So this is your while. Okay, this is the while thing I was talking about, where if it's not empty, you wait. Here is not. If it's zero, then you wait. The same code that I showed you in the abstract is, you can see how to write this in C++. So this is your producer. This is the consumer. This is checking if there is at least, if there are no items in the buffer, then you are going to wait. The consumer is going to check for buffer underflows. If the buffer is empty, you are going to wait. Okay? Exact same code that I was showing you. Okay, then you put an object in the buffer and then you do a signal. Okay. So here your signal will cause this to wake up. Okay, this is a condition variable. This is a while. Okay, because I said this is a multi-threaded code. You are using Mesa style semantics, so this cannot be if. So you will do a while. If it's still zero, you go back to sleep. Otherwise, you come out, take an object out, you do a signal, and then you do an unlock. So if you had actually implemented synchronized here, this lock and unlock would not be necessary. Okay? But you can always write your own code, not use the word synchronized, do explicit locking, which is what this code is doing. Okay? But you could have just made that synchronized, in which case you wouldn't need to do this. Okay, yes, question. Where is it throwing? Oh, this one. Is that necessary? I'm not sure. I'll have to look at what interrupted exception does. Okay, let me look at it to get back to you. Okay, the same code I was showing you on the slide, all written in Java using condition variable explicit locking, not using synchronized. Okay, so do go and look at all this. You will actually find a lot of interesting examples of how you can use this in Java. All that said, first programming assignment doesn't require you to use monitors or condition variable. Okay, only semaphores. Okay.
Do you have to do it in semaphores, or we?
Yeah, you have to do it in semaphores.
Required.
Yes. Because if it was monitors, it would be very simple. There wouldn't be much to do. Okay, so let me now spend some time talking about the lab. Bring that up just to show you. Okay, so I presume this was discussed yesterday, but let me just draw some pictures, show you exactly what we are trying to achieve here. So the example, the assignment is to use this notion of producers and consumers and bounded buffers that will be based on semaphores. Okay. And then you have to write an application using this abstract notion of producers and consumers, and that application is basically will have a parallel version of generating that inverted index thing you did in the first lab. Okay? Parallel inverted index. We'll use a particular way to parallelize it. That particular technique is referred to as MapReduce. Okay? This is a popular paradigm for doing data processing in cloud computing. Okay? In this course, you really don't need to understand the MapReduce framework at all. I'm just using the same structure here in a much more sort of simplistic sort of toy version. Okay? So, your producer, so this is the producers. These are the consumers. Okay. Producers are essentially what are called map threads. Okay. And the consumers are the reduced threads. Okay. And you can, your program should be able to start arbitrary numbers of maps and reduce. This will be specified as an input, saying you will have n of these and m of the, is it the other way around? Okay, M map threads. So then, that's M. Okay, so let me explain how the parallel inverted index works. So we'll assume that now the data for constructing the index, which is all the text data, is now partitioned into multiple files. This will be given to your program as input. Okay, so you'll have foo1.txt, foo2.txt. So if you have M threads here, assume that there are M such files. m.txt. So each of these can have arbitrary number of textual text lines. Okay? So you will construct m map threads. Okay? Each thread is basically going to open and read exactly one file. Okay? Thread I should read foo_i.txt. Okay? Is that clear? Okay. So what does each of these map threads do? All you are doing here is you are basically doing tokenization. You are extracting words from this file. Okay? So you will basically, thread I will read this, it will extract the words. So you will basically have a sequence of words. Okay? And then you will actually send these words over to the reduced thread to actually construct the inverted index. Okay? So here you are just doing parallel processing of the text input. So if you had a large file or large amount of text, you will assume that they are somehow partitioned into n data, n files, and each thread reads a file in parallel to other threads. Okay? And it reads the file, it extracts the words, and then these words have to be sent to the reduced threads. And the way they are actually sent to the reduced threads is where your bounded buffer producer consumer comes in. So you take each word and you add it to this bounded buffer. Okay? Bounded buffer has a size 10. Could be arbitrary, I just simplified it and said size 10 buffer. Okay. So you basically read the words and you keep appending to the buffer. Okay. So there are n of these bounded buffers, one for each reduced threads. Okay. The question is, how do you know which buffer to put this in? Okay. For that we will use a hash function. Okay. So you will say hash on this word. This hash function will generate an integer that goes from 1 to n, and then depending on which number you hash into, you put it in that buffer. Take a word, let's say the word is pepper. That's a string. You will use the hash function, you will hash on pepper, it will give you an integer from 1 to n. Okay, you can pick a hash function or we can help you choose an appropriate one. Okay. So give the hash function given a word should always hash on to a number that goes from 1 to n. So if this paper hashes to, let's say, 3, then you put this in the third bounded buffer, which means it's sent to the third reduced thread for processing. Okay. So every time any of these threads finds this word paper, it will always go into the same buffer.
What does the hash function depend on? Like, how does it generate?
So here you can pick any arbitrary hash function that's already built into Java. I will ask the TA to help you figure out some classes that you can use. In general, you can pick any arbitrary hash function. It doesn't matter. All that the hash function has to do is say, given this word, which reduced thread should process this word. And the same word should always be sent to the same reduced thread. So the basic point is, given arbitrary set of words, you're partitioning the words into n sets, and these reduced threads are going to process them in parallel. Yes, question.
Would a queue make more sense?
Would a queue make more sense?
Because then threads don't actually
test. No, so there is a reason you have to actually always send a particular word to a particular thread to construct that inverted index. Okay? Because inverted index is for counting how many times a word appears in all of these files. So if the word paper appears in, let's say, file foo1, foo3 and foo5, it always has to be sent to the same thread so that it can say this word appeared thrice in all of these files. You can't send the same word to different threads, then you will get an incorrect count.
So the producers get the information about the word in which file it appeared? And
each producer is processing one file. Each word that you encounter is hashed and it is sent to one of the reduced threads. The assumption is the same hash function is used by all the map threads. So if the same word appears in other files, it will be sent to the same thread. So that thread can count how many times did this word appear. Is this paper appear once, 10 times, 100, they will always be sent here. Okay? And then the other thing the hash function is doing is doing division of labor. Given an arbitrary set of words, it is partitioning it n ways. So each reduced thread does one nth of the work to count the words. Yes. Will there be n unique word types? There can be arbitrary number of words. All that your hash function is doing is for each word, it will assign that word to one of the threads. That's it. The number of words could be arbitrary. It's not that there are n words. That's it. So multiple words could map onto the same threads, right? So you could have pickle can also map on this hash function can also do 3. So you will also send that to 3. So each reduced thread can count multiple words. Yeah, so multiple words can map onto the same thread.
The idea is that you're not just pushing the integer you get from the hash function into the bounded buffer, you're pushing the word into the integer with that corresponding.
Absolutely. You push the word, you push the file name, so it's an inverted index. Not only do you have to count how many times the word appeared, you have to keep track of which file it appeared in. This is essentially what Google does to construct this inverted index. When you type in a query, it has an inverted index which says which documents has this word appeared in. So it has essentially done this for you and constructed that index. Okay? Yes, question.
Is it the hash returns the number of times or the number of documents that word has been found?
No. Hash just tells you, given this word, send it to this thread for processing. You don't do any processing in the map thread. I haven't even told you what the processing is. Processing is all being done here. Okay? All that the maps are doing is, I read a file, I grab a word, I say where should I send it. That's it. I don't do anything else. I just say, okay, this pickle, send it to thread 2. Word pepper, send it to thread 5.
Don't you have to have the information
about the word? What information? Yeah, so you will insert the word, so I haven't told you what is happening in the bounded buffer. I'm just explaining this. Okay? What you will append here, this is your bounded buffer, is the word itself. So let's say it's pickle, you say it appeared in foo3.txt, it appeared on line number 3. This is the entry that you are going to insert into the bounded buffer. Okay? So if this appears somewhere else, you will again have another entry eventually in this buffer, say foo5.txt, and it will have some line number 1. Okay. So these are just being dumped into this buffer. This is bounded, so if the buffer fills up, the map thread has to block, and so on. All that you have to do, yes.
If it appeared in different lines in the same file?
Yeah. Every time you see a word, just send it in. All you're doing is linearly scanning through this document. Every word is just being sent to a map thread. If the word appears another time, we'll just put it again. That doesn't matter. Right, so you basically say, let's say pickle, pepper, pickle. If this is the string, you'll take pickle, you'll send it somewhere. You'll take pepper, you'll send it somewhere. You'll take pickle, hash it, send it again to the same place, same thread that you send the first pickle. Okay, so every time you encounter a word, you'll send it. That's all you're doing in the map task.
I thought you just said you have to keep track of which line and file.
Yes, you will keep track of that because that's what you do in this map thread. Because what you're inserting is not just the word, but the file name, okay, and the line number. Because you are reading through it, you keep track of which line you're on. The same thing you did in lab 1. You kept track of the line number. Okay, so you already know the line number you're reading from. Just in
separate, then keeping track of that. Yeah, same thing.
Yes. So you basically know the current line number, you know the file name. Each thread is only reading one file, so that's clear. Your thread I, you're reading foo I dot text. Okay, so you know if your thread I that I am reading foo I dot text. So any word that I put in there will always have foo I dot text appended with the word. Okay, and then I know which line I'm. Am I on line 1, 2, 3? Every time I encounter a new line, I basically increment the line number, and then I basically send that line number with me. So that tells me where in the file I have actually encountered this word.
And how do you want to handle opening a file? Do you just want to have the first an argument specified directly for all files?
Yeah, so that all is, you can make some simple assumption, that's fine. You can run the code in the directory where all the files are. File names are assumed to be known. They're all foo I, foo with a number dot text. Okay. You could specify a directory as a command line. Just whatever you use, just say in the your README file, this is how you start the program, okay, and this is how you specify the file name or the directory or whatever it is. Okay, so now let's talk about reduce. So thus far I only said, how is the map actually processing these files? So now what is the reduce thread doing? These are all consumers, so they are actually consuming all the words that the map threads are sending you. Okay. So the consumer or reduce thread here has to keep track of the number of times you encounter each word. Okay. So every time I encounter a new word, I initialize this counter to 1. Every time I encounter a word I've already encountered before, I increment its counter again. And for each instance, I also keep track of which file, what line number. So if the word pepper appears 100 times, and it appears in 10 files, and in each file it appears multiple times, I have to say it appeared in foo.txt, it appeared on line numbers 2, 7, 21, and so on. And then it appeared in line foo5.txt on these line numbers. So all that you have to keep track of. Okay? You can use a hash map if you want, like you did last time. Okay? So you basically try to insert a word. The word already exists, then you will basically add some more information to that entry in the hash map. Okay, yes, question.
If the word appears in the same line, do we have to
just increment the count in that case?
But we don't have to tell it twice that it appears like line 1 again, line 1.
You don't have to do that. So long as you get the count right, you have the line number, that's good enough. Okay? Yes?
I understand that there's for keeping track of the set of unique lines per file. Is it counts per file or total count?
Total count. Okay? You are counting how many times has this word appeared. That's the total frequency of the word, okay, across all the files. Okay. In addition to the total count across all the files, you also keep track of which specific file it appeared in and the line number. Okay. The count is the same as what you did last time for lab 1. Last time was only one file. Okay. But you still have to keep track of the total count and you have to keep track of the line numbers. It's just a generalization. Here you have multiple files. You still have a count across all files and you have line numbers. But line numbers have to be associated with file names, which is why you have the file name and the line number within that file. Okay? And then to do all this, you need to use the semaphore class, okay, to do bounded buffer. I already showed you some Java code that does this. Okay? I also have the pseudo code in the previous lecture, okay, which is mentioned somewhere here. Okay, so it says go look at this lecture 8, page 19, you will see that pseudocode, same pseudocode that I just showed you. Okay, that the pseudocode I showed you was condition variable, so that's not what you're using, but the principle is the same. You need to use semaphores. Okay. So there's a semaphore class in Java, which is right here. Okay, so this is what you use. Okay. The one last thing I haven't mentioned here, okay, is when do you start, when do consumers output the inverted index they have computed. You can only output your inverted index. There will be n of these, right? So each of them will have a count of some number of words that are encountered. You can only start outputting when you know all the map tasks are done. While the map tasks are still going, some word may still be sent to you, so you can't start printing. That counts will keep getting incremented. So there has to be a way for the reduce threads to know when the maps threads are done. Okay? And that's the last point here. So what you will do is you will have a shared variable which is the number of, so let's call it num maps. Okay, so initially you set this to M, which says all maps. So this tells you how many maps threads are still computing, aren't done yet. Okay. So every time a map task finishes, meaning it read through the end of the file, it's done, okay, it will go and decrement this counter. Okay. When all the map threads are done, that counter will go to zero. Okay. So what the consumers have to do is to periodically check, has that counter gone to zero? If the counter has gone to zero, it's safe for me to output my subset of the inverted index. Okay, because there's no more words coming, all the map threads are done, the buffer is, I've already read whatever I need to read from my buffer. Okay, so when that is done, and then when your buffer is empty, there is no work for you to do. At this point, you can go and print out your inverted index. Okay, so this is just a way to check when can a consumer thread actually print its info, thing it has computed. Yes.
So as the buffer, as these are
no, you print at the end. You can print whatever you want for debugging. Okay, but the real output you want is basically, given these things, let all the map threads process these files, let all the consumer threads read whatever these things have been inserted into the buffer, then each thread is going to say, I am reduced thread 1, this is what I computed. Somebody else will say, I am reduced thread 2, this is what I computed, and so on. That's it. Yes, each reduced thread will have to have its own hash map. Hash map is not global, so you are computing. This is parallel implementation. So each of them is doing their own work. Okay? So there is no religious.
So the final output doesn't have to be sorted?
Final output doesn't have to be sorted. I simplified it for you. In real map reduce, you will actually resort that output and print it in sorted order, in alphabetical order. Here I'm not asking you to do that, because then your reduce will have to do more work by coordinating. Yes. For it to be useful, it absolutely needs to be in sorted order, yes.
I mean, so to do that, I mean, once the all the reduced threads have emptied their buffers and realized that the counter is decremented to zero, presumably parallelizing an alphabetized output would be pretty complicated.
Yep. So that would have required additional work. You are free to sort within a thread if you want. Even that I'm not requiring you to do. They're just saying thread I will only sort its own thing. But really, if you wanted this to be useful, each of the inverted index have to be merged and resorted.
Well, if there's time, I guess, is it acceptable to have just one big alphabetized output
that would be ideal.
Parallel, but
yeah. Okay. If you want to do that as an extra thing, that I think that's the real I actually wanted to do that. The TA talked me out of it, saying it may be too much work. So that's why that part doesn't appear here. Okay, so it's simpler, but you're welcome to do it, because that's really what needs to be done. Yes, question.
The counter, the num map scale, do you have to implement that in semaphore 2?
This one?
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a semaphore. It probably all you need to do is have a lock. Just grab a lock, decrement it, release the lock. Here you periodically grab the lock, check the value, that's it. So you don't have to do anything. Okay? Yes.
Yeah,
so output, here is the sample output, it says the word name, it talks about the file name and the line number it appears. Something like this is good enough. Okay? Okay, so.